Okay, good evening everybody, and thank you for coming to this event tonight. I'm very pleased to be chairing the event, not only because it's about my native country, but also because it's on a topic that I'm very fond of, and having worked and researched on it, which is on civil society. I am pleased to introduce today the speaker, who is also a fellow at the LISI Research on Southeastern Europe here at LSE, Dr. Max Frass, who works as consultant, analyst, trainer for the British Council, European Commission, Council of Europe, across Southeastern Europe, Eastern Europe, and Southern Caucasus. His professional expertise covers civil society, education, research, culture, youth policy, international development, cooperation, etc. His research interests include EU enlargement policy, Council of Europe, social policy, youth policy, religion and public life, intercultural dialogue, multiculturalism and migration. Dr. Max Frass also holds an MA degree from Wroclaw University and the Cambridge Centre for Jewish Christian Relations, as well as a PhD in social sciences from the Open University in the UK. Max will be talking today about civil society development, the latest civil society development in Albania, with a very intriguing title, Do No Harm, Government Policy Towards Civil Society in Albania. He will be talking about 30-40 minutes. What's your plan?
That's the plan. Without interruptions. That is the plan.
And then we'll open the floor for questions and discussions. Yes, so Max?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone.
I did forget to say the hashtag thing. So the hashtag for the event today, in case you'd like to tweet at LISI LSE, is hashtag LSE Albania. Thank you.
Yes, it's right up there. So, good evening. Thank you very much for coming. Particular thanks to those of you who made it from other parts of London, and to all of you for giving up some of the few sunny days we've seen recently in London. So thank you very much for being here. I'll try to stick to the plan, that is 30 and 40 minutes, but I'll be very happy if this was followed by by a discussion and questions. So as Ed already kindly said, the main focus of my presentation is government policy towards civil society in Albania. And I'll start by just giving a brief outline of what I'll be talking about. Those are the main chapters, so to speak, of my presentation. I'll start by saying just a couple of words about civil society in Albania. Now, civil society is obviously a huge field, and I will not be providing a historical outline of what happened in civil society. My focus is a little more narrow here today. I would like to talk about civil society organizations, so not civil society at large, but civil society organizations and how does government policy influence them. So we'll be talking a lot about what the Albanian government does or does not do to enable or sometimes disable the smooth operation of civil society organizations in Albania. I'll be talking about the current policies that affect Albanian civil society organizations. I'll be talking briefly about the drivers of change and enabling factors. I'll be talking about the institutions, organizations, and processes that drive change, and in this case, positive change in civil society environment in Albania. And I'll try to talk about enabling factors. So what factors make Albanian civil society organizations' lives easier. I'll briefly outline a few problems and obstacles, and I hope this will be followed by questions and discussions from the floor. Now, added background to this, I spent quite a bit of time in Albania recently, so a lot of my work is based on the research I did on various assignments for the Council of Europe and for the European Commission while in Albania. A lot of the information I'll be presenting is quite recent. So, just a few words about civil society in Albania. I think most experts in Southeast Europe studies would be no surprise there was virtually no civil society, at least no organized civil society in Albania until 1991. And the fall of communism was followed by rapid and largely unregulated growth of civil society organizations in the 1990s. It was a trend that affected most of this part of Europe. And it was followed by some regulation and slow growth in early 2000s, so the current law on the registration of non-governmental organizations was put in place in 2001, and large parts of it are still observed. Then a certain policy stagnation over the last decades. I'm not talking about vibrancy of civil society at large. I'm not saying Albanian civil society was stagnant, actually quite the opposite. There was a lot of activity going on. But when it comes to government policy towards it, there was not much progress. And that's a conclusion that a lot of researchers and international development practitioners agree upon. There was a certain level of development that was reached by around 2005, 2007, and not much has changed since, in terms of the policy framework, that is. Now, when it comes to the last couple of years and the increased activity of civil society organizations, I try to argue that this happened in spite of the current framework not changing. So it seems that in many situations, civil society and civil society organizations are able to contribute to public debate, to be quite visible, quite present in public discourse, even in some elements of policy making, despite there not being a massive policy drive and a massive change in the legal or institutional environment surrounding them. So they do it by force of their own capacities, own sustainability, and the resources they have at hand, rather limited, I should say. So moving on to civil society organizations and government policy, this is again quite a big picture, but just trying to group this in a few main areas. So how can government policy influence the development and the functioning of civil society organizations? So we're talking about the legal framework, and I'll talk about this in the next part of this presentation, but we also have to pay a lot of attention to the enforcement of legislation, and that is quite a current issue in Albania now. So a lot of the legislation is left unenforced because of the lack of bylaws or just poor monitoring of policy implementation. A lot of this is about informal governance, so the networks and the contacts between the various parts of the policy cycle that happen outside the official remit. Quite a bit about the discourse, and I will be talking about this briefly as well. So I should say that when it comes to the general discourse about civil society policy on part of the government, it's rather positive. The government, the previous Albanian government, the current Albanian government, most of them would say that they welcome civil society activity, that they would like to help Albanian civil society to flourish, and that, well, in recent years at least, there is little attempt at state control over civil society organizations. But that does not mean that this is followed up by developments in the legal framework or enforcement of relevant legislation. There's a number of enabling and disabling factors, and I'll be reviewing them when I go through the different areas of civil society organizations' activity in Albania. So when it comes to the current policy environment for Albanian civil society organizations, I'll be talking about the background, that is mostly the lack of coordination and coherence in the development of civil society policy, and I'll be talking about matters of setting up and registration of civil society organizations, so the conditions for starting a civil society organization in Albania. Then I'll be talking in more detail about operating and activities of civil society organizations, that's matters of taxation, reporting, and accounting. So day-to-day operations of civil society organizations. Then I'll mention briefly civil society organizations' role in policy making and their role in public debate, particularly European integration issues, because they've been a driving force behind a lot of elements of European integration in Albania over the last decade or so. So when it comes to current policy environment of Albanian civil society organizations, well, the background that I briefly mentioned already was unregulated growth in the 1990s. So a lot of the legislation that was not connected across different government departments. As of today, so as of 2018, the Albanian government does not have a strategy for civil society development. This is not to say that such a strategy can make or break a civil society environment, but there is no strategy, there is no vision as to what should Albanian civil society policy look like. There are ideas within the civil society as to what it should do, but there is no strategy as to what the government would like to do. There are elements of strategy, so there is a roadmap for civil society development, there are different institutions such as the State Agency for Civil Society Support, there is a certain amount of funding for civil society organizations dispersed by the central government, and quite a lot of it at local level, but there is no big strategy underpinning that, so there's a lack of coherence in policy. When it comes to historical development of Albanian civil society organizations, you could note high influence of the donor community, so because there was virtually no civil society, organized civil society in before 1991. A lot of the schemes and solutions and legal frameworks were developed with the help of international donors, so we could point to UN agencies, a lot of European bodies, so now European Commission delegation and other EU institutions. Persistent lack of representation, so again, as of today, there isn't a single representative body, and again, it's not the case for a lot of the countries, but Albanian civil society organizations suffer a lot of fragmentation, and that impacts their ability to represent their interests at the government level. And a certain lack of continuity that, again, is typical of Albania, I would say, in many areas of governance. So there are a lot of government projects that just get abandoned or reversed once a new government comes to power. So there was little continuity in the way that those civil society frameworks have been developed. So moving on to the first element of policy environment for civil society organizations, that the matters of setting up and registration. It continues to be a massive burden for civil society organizations that are already in there to deal with the registration system. But assuming that we're talking about new ideas and sort of start-up civil society organizations, registration is quite a hurdle because the current legislation states that civil society organizations, so NGOs, associations, can only register at Tirana first instance court. And if you're lucky enough to be in Tirana, which is the case for a lot of people in Albania, that's great because you're in the same place. But if you're not, then you're facing a trip with other possible board members to the court to register your organization, usually multiple trips. So there's already quite a high administrative and resource burden on civil society initiatives before they even become organizations. And this then is followed up by everything that's the results from this arrangement, the lack of records, lack of management information system, and the general unfriendliness of the whole registration system. So the lack of digital records might be a technicality, but it is a significant obstacle in evidence-based policymaking. So depending on who you talk to in Albania at the moment, you might get a different picture of what the civil society organizations are and how many of them are there. So the court would tell you that over 9,000 were registered since 1991, and that might be a very impressive number, but it might not reflect, I mean, it definitely does not reflect the number of organizations that are currently operating. The data is not updated, and the courts themselves do not have a full picture of how many of those are legally or economically active at the moment. Now, if you ask the tax authorities, and they usually take a little more interest in civil society matters, you could hear that about 1,900 active civil society organizations exist and operate in the country. There's a big discrepancy between those two numbers, which might mean that a lot of the organizations registered deregistered, whether legally or de facto, because the registration process is also rather complex and a lot of the organizations just become inactive without going through an official deregistration process. For a lot of them, it's a matter of becoming inactive, and here again, Albanian government's policy, or rather the tax authority's policy, is to consider any civil society organization that is economically inactive over more than 12 months to be defunct. Now, if you know the reality of civil society organizations in Southeast Europe, but not only there, a lot of them would rely on grant and project funding and would not have a sustainable source of funding. So not having a source of funding for 12 months would not mean that they're not operational anymore or they've closed down, but it just means that they are struggling to raise funds. Now, the lack of management information system, as I already mentioned, you have a different way of registering and accounting for NGOs, so to speak, within the court system, within the tax system, within government departments, within the state agency for civil society. Now, when it comes to actual operations, so once organizations register, what awaits them is, a highly bureaucratic environment. So one of the first requirements is a staffing requirement, so every operating and functional civil society organization is required to have one full-time employee. And again, it would be great if all of them could afford to do so, but for a lot of them it becomes an administrative burden because it's quite a high cost affair in Albania to have one full-time employee, and in that case you could see that civil society organizations are very often treated as businesses. So there's very little distinction between profit and non-profit operators. So if you are a non-profit organization, you very often meet the same requirements on behalf of tax authorities and registration authorities as a business, and this applies to taxation. So most Albanian civil society organizations, with very few exceptions, including those that work with international funding, are taxed on the same basis as business entities. And there's nothing wrong with it as such, if it wasn't for the fact that it also means that very often there's no trained staff, and there's no capacity within local tax authorities to treat them differently. So, let's say all grant funding is treated as profit, or all activity is considered economic activity, where even if they do declare it as non-profit, it would not be considered as such by tax authorities. VAT issues, very connected, but of a slightly different nature. It's more of an issue of legal consistency. So there is a piece of legislation that says that non-economic activity is VAT exempt, and Albanian civil society organizations that do not engage in economic activity and profit making, they should not be paying value-added tax. But on the other hand, the way that this legislation is enforced by tax authorities means that it's virtually impossible for them to register as non-profits. And this even applies to donor funding. So I'll be talking about sustainability of funding a little later, but a lot of Albanian civil society organizations depend on international donor funding, and a lot of this funding would come from European Union, and by definition that it should be VAT exempt. But in order to get this exemption, they have to register with the tax authorities at the start of a given financial framework, if it's a contract, a project, or program, and they need to obtain an exemption certificate. Now, there is no exact data on that, but anecdotal evidence have it that very few of them, not to say none, succeed in obtaining those certificates and end up paying the tax anyway. Now, on top of that, there is a lack of individual donation system. So there are no tax exemptions for individual donations. Businesses can donate to civil society organizations and be tax exempt to a certain percentage. Individuals cannot. This is a piece of legislation that the Albanian government is currently working on, but as of now, there's no tax exemption system for individual donations for civil society organizations. Another issue worth mentioning in terms of current and day-to-day operations of civil society organizations is the way that the banking system treats them. So if they're lucky enough, the banking system would treat them as a business customer, which again might be perfectly acceptable to most civil society organizations, but it also means that the costs of a day-to-day banking for them remain quite high, and there are no exemptions for charities or non-profits in the area. On the other hand, they are subject to additional hurdles, allegedly because of current money laundering legislation, that they have to reconfirm the composition of their board pretty much every single time they undertake any banking operation. And depending on the activity levels of an organization, this might not be a big burden, but for a lot of them, especially if they are based further away from a bank branch, this is a substantial burden on their day-to-day operations. Every time they try to take money out of the bank or proceed with a banking transaction, they need to visit the Tirana First Instance Court. So that is the additional burden. They have to travel to the place of registration in order to prove that their board members have not changed. Now, when it comes to various other areas of operations, so the first slide appealed or referred to areas of operation that all civil society organizations engage in, so taxation, VAT, and so on. But when it comes to other areas, there's some specific provisions where the policy framework isn't helping, to say the least. One such piece would be the volunteering law, and this is an interesting case of civil society participation in policy making, which we talked about just now, and I'll also refer to this later. So the volunteering law was developed on the initiative of two MPs of a party that used to be part of a coalition government, no longer there, and they've developed the law on volunteering that affects primarily civil society organizations without consulting the whole sector, and actually in spite of the sector proposing another piece of legislation. This legislation was then passed and resulted in many ways blocking volunteering activities across Albania, because the law has required all Albanian civil society organizations, so pretty much everybody who would like to engage in volunteering activities, to register all their volunteers through a central system. That's for one, and the system is not even in place. And the other one is to provide all volunteers for full level of social insurance on par with full-time employees, which even for employees of civil society organizations is a high burden, not to mention volunteers that are, I mean, by definition, unpaid. Now, another point is that a lot of the provisions for funding, including the public service regulations or funding coming from central or local government, remain unfinished, to say the least. So there is a huge opportunity for civil society organizations in Albania to engage in service provision for central government and for local government. But at the moment, the legislation to that effect is not complete, so they cannot participate in tenders, and they cannot bid against profit-making organizations. The whole public funding framework is fragmented. So there's a bit of central government funding disbursed mainly through the Agency for State Support for Civil Society Development, and that's one pot of money. There are different pots of money distributed by ministries, and there's a lot of funding distributed at local level, but this is not coordinated, not even connected in any way, so it cannot be managed at central government policy level. It cannot respond to current needs or priorities of the government or of the country. So if there's a state of emergency because of a natural catastrophe or disaster, the government does not have an apparatus to channel the money this or that way, because the different funding instruments are not connected. Further on the funding front, so business donations are tax exempt, and that's of great help to civil society organizations. A lot of them would already benefit from business donations, and there's already quite a culture of business support for civil society organizations in Albania, especially in the area of social policy, health, and youth and children's rights. There's a lot of support rendered by business organizations. Individual donations do occur, of course, but they're not recognized and they're not tax exempt at the moment, so there is very little aggregated data on that. So it's hard to say, but anecdotal evidence from civil society organizations themselves suggest that membership fees and individual donations are marginal significance in supporting civil society organizations. Now, a lot of the support, financial support especially, but also resources would come from other resources, would come from international donors, but that's limited in scope, first of all geographically, because most of the donors would be sat either abroad or in Tirana, and the funding is not equally available to all organizations. And then there is a matter of rather close networks that operate around certain donor organizations. So there's a certain number of organizations that would always benefit from United Nations funding. They know the system and they can apply for grants. The same would apply to the EU system, a little bit to Council of Europe, but the amount of money there is much, much lower. Same would go for World Bank and other donors. And the whole notion of fundraising is quite limited. So there's the arsenal of fundraising tools at disposal of civil society organizations is quite limited, and that affects their day-to-day operations. And the government policy is, well, the do no harm tag applies here, is at best not harming, but it's not really helping them in terms of tax exemptions or structural support. Now, moving on to how civil society organizations can influence or change the situation, a lot of this depends on their role in policy making. Now, first of all, in their role in policy making in general, and secondly, in their role and opportunity to influence the policy that affects them, so to lobby and to advocate for changes in tax law and registration law and volunteering law that would benefit the whole sector. So what happens with the policy making set up, so to speak? I mean, there's one principal framework, that's the law on public consultation, that's in place for a couple of years already, is that there is a basic provision for public consultation that the government ministries are using, but it's used in a very, it's applied in a very limited fashion. So the law states that legislative proposals need to be consulted for 5 weeks, and most government ministries would even observe this law, but the format of the consultations will be very limited. So there's an online platform that is a very simple IT tool that allows so-called interest groups to voice their opinion on proposed legislation, policy changes. But similarly to the tax legislation, it does not allow for distinction between for-profits and non-profits. So civil society organizations are either deterred from participating or are invisible in the wider scope of consultations because their voices are put together with the for-profit organizations, with sometimes sorry, other economic actors. So there's no distinction between civil society input to policymaking and other interest groups. Now, there's within the same system, there's virtually no feedback on the consultations and where do they go within the online system. So you can contribute to it, but you're not going to see what happened on the basis of the information, on the feedback provided. And there's a lack of follow-up to those consultations. So again, anecdotal evidence from a lot of the NGOs would be that they sometimes do not have the human capacity to participate in consultations if there are so many, but what they don't get is feedback and information on where the consultation outputs end up and how they're being used in drafting new legislation. Now, this is one framework for contribution to policymaking. Another one is operated by the Albanian parliament. There's very little coordination between those two systems, so the Albanian government would have a unit for civil society and interest group consultations and would be, I would say, rather proactive in collecting information, but in a very uncoordinated manner. So because of the lack of centralized database or any database for the matter with civil society organizations, it ends up reaching only a small number or a small circle of civil society organizations, most of them available for consultations in Tirana, because most of those happen within in parliament premises, sorry. Okay. So moving on to the wider picture behind civil society consultations, there are other frameworks. So there's a Albania We Love framework that the current government is pushing as an alternative to public consultation system that also allows volunteers and civil society organizations and citizens to contribute and to voice their opinions on policy matters. The Prime Minister's office has a separate framework for consultations and a center for dialogue where it solicits opinions and contributions from civil society as well, but this is not connected. So a lot of the voices and contributions of civil society end up lost in the system because they are not brought together under one roof. And the civil society itself faces capacity issues, so a lot of organizations would not know how to structure the feedback or contributions to policy dialogue and would not have the resources for the matters that I listed before: limited public funding, limited staffing within organizations that would not be able to engage with all consultations happening around them because there will be so many of them happening, and they would all require a voluntary contribution on their behalf and very often providing expert knowledge. So again, there are cases of mostly Tirana-based, rather expert civil society organizations / think tanks that would develop legislation sometimes on behalf, sometimes for different government departments, and this would very often be disregarded and alternative proposals would be taken on board. That was the case with the volunteering law, and that was also the case with the National Council on European Integration, another body that's supposed to allow civil society organizations to contribute to public discourse and public debate on European integration issues. Now, when it comes to their role in policy making in civil society matters, there is quite an array of organizations where they could contribute. One of them is the National Council for Civil Society. It's a new body that was established only a few years ago and was only became partially operational last year, but it's now going through a process of renewal due to the reform of Albanian central government administration. It's a body that brings together civil society organizations and government ministries, and as an idea, it might help civil society to, first of all, get their voices heard by the government, but also to increase trust and to reduce the distance between civil society organizations and government ministries. But it's not an industry body. It's a governmental institution that is half civil society, half government ministries. And again, even the government ministries are not represented duly because of the government reforms. So some ministries have merged, some have been abolished, and they cannot participate fully in the meetings until they've agreed between themselves who's coming on board. And there's an agency for the support of civil society that does not enjoy the greatest of trust and esteem among civil society organizations, that disburses funding and also provides limited resource support to civil society organizations. but does not have the capacity to facilitate policy dialogue. There's what I already said, lack of sector representation. So there's no single umbrella organization for civil society organizations. There are sectoral umbrella organizations. So let's say those that deal with social service provision would have their organization. Volunteering organizations would have one. Those that work with children's rights would have one. But those voices are, again, very often fragmented and opposing. And there isn't a single voice that speaks to the government about those universal civil society issues, including taxation, registration, donations, policy making, that are valid and important for all civil society organizations. And on top of that, there is a lack of capacity in advocacy and lobbying. It's a function of the lack of financial and staff capacity. So a lot of the organizations would not have the capacity to engage in any form of advocacy and lobbying. And on the other hand, there will be a lot of organizations with good access to corridors of power that would sometimes monopolize contributions to legal changes and policy making. Now, when it comes to the role in public discourse and activity of civil society at large, this is not all bad news. So what I talked about is the fact that the legal framework and the institutional framework and even the non-formal or the informal arrangements are not helpful. This doesn't mean that the civil society's role in public debate, in public discourse and in policy making isn't great, but that sometimes happens by the virtue of strength of certain singular actors that can forge coalitions around particular issues. So one such case would be the recent campaign about Valbona. I mean, it's part of North Albania that might not be quite as beautiful as it is because of some infrastructural changes and investment, and a lot of civil society organizations based there are opposed to that, and they created quite a wide movement that goes under an Albanian hashtag that I cannot pronounce, but it translates into "Do not touch my Valbona," I think. So it's about protecting the environment and heritage in that part of the country. Another one around the Gerdes explosion, or the waste recycling scandal, or the judicial reform. So a lot of the issues that are very high on the agenda, in both for the government and civil society, bring people together for campaigning purposes. But this is not by virtue of a supportive policy environment. It's very often despite lack of support and lack of possibility for civil society organizations to come together, and it very often happens that this activity might be making a lot of noise in media and social media, and might even get the Prime Minister's ear, but would not translate into policy developments. So there will be a lot of protest against a policy development, there will be a lot of media noise about this, but it would not be followed through in policy development. And, well, the third point is a bit of a surprise for me as well, spending some time in Albania recently, that European integration matters, that are some of the enabling factors and drivers of change in Albania, have been deprioritized because of the other problems that the government and the society is facing, including reform of the judiciary, decriminalization, problems with budgeting, and the education reform, for example. So this has all overshadowed matters of European integration and is not being treated as a priority, at least that's the opinion of civil society organizations on the ground at the moment. So in terms of who could possibly influence and change the situation, so based on the research I've done so far, I see that the greatest strength and the greatest drive to move things forward is within the civil society organizations themselves. So they are getting support from elsewhere, and those organizations or institutions are listed below, but evidence from the recent policy changes and the campaigns on specific policy issues show that civil society organizations and the strength that comes from their own structures and their own constituencies around particular issues, whether it's environment or children's rights, are the biggest drivers of change. Now, when it comes to institutions, there is a certain level of awareness of civil society policy within the Prime Minister's office, but it does not translate into what's happening within government ministries. So it'd be very often the case that the very, very center of government would be generally in favor of a change or a policy development, but it would not be followed through by line ministries. And the Prime Minister's office, as in many cases, most countries in Europe at least, would not be responsible for policy implementation and would not be following through the policy cycle. So it would give a signal, it would give an order sometimes for policy changes to happen, but it would not be followed through by the public administration that is plagued by its own problems of capacity, funding, staff retention, and so on. And another driver of change could be the National Council for Civil Society if it becomes operational, because it would be a body that brings together government bodies and government bodies and civil society organizations in one room on a regular basis, and that will maybe allow for a policy change to be more long term, and for civil society organizations and the government to work them out jointly. Now, international donor community is one of the big drivers of change in many areas of policy making in Albania, in civil society, so rather specifically. And here, European Union stands out as one of the most active bodies and organizations. Now, there is no strict obligation to improve the legal environment for civil society organizations as part of Albania's European integration process that it's about to accelerate this year. But it is perceived as a high priority for European Union in general, and it might be that the European Union in general and European Union's presence in Albania specifically will try to drive forward a more enabling environment, a more friendly environment for civil society organizations that would then in turn be able to influence European integration processes. So they should be they should be involved in the negotiation process, they should be involved in implementation of a lot of the acquis later on, at least in terms of monitoring. And that is the function that that the European Union's institutions in Albania care for very much. Now, last but not least, and it's a single point, but it's a whole group of people, is a lot of individuals with civil society experience. So evidence shows that if you have a member of parliament with a lot of experience within civil society, they would very much want to push the civil society agenda forward, as would be with anything else. So the unfortunate thing is that there are very few high-level politicians within the current government, for example, or within the governing party, with strong civil society background, who would want to move this forward. The same applies to civil servants. So, I mean, civil service is a whole different topic. So that there's a lot of problems in terms of the institutional arrangements instead of staffing. But there are a lot of people there with their hearts in the right place, who would like to help civil society, who would like to move things forward, but it's very often the case of individuals rather than the whole system being supportive of civil society organizations. And very often there's a lack of understanding of civil society specificity or problems. They're very often treated the same as other interest groups or the same as other businesses for policy consultation purposes. Now, enabling factors, some of which I already mentioned when I talked about drivers of change, is the ongoing public administration reform that should streamline policy making and should allow for more smooth implementation of a more enabling framework for civil society. So the government is currently in the process of revising a roadmap for a more enabling environment for civil society development, and all of the issues that I listed there are reflected to some extent, so the issue of taxation, registration, day-to-day operations, employment, and so on. And they might be pushed forward through the public administration reform as well. There's a general increased public awareness of civil society's influence on the basis of the recent campaigns about environment, about education and volunteering as well. The whole European integration process provides an opportunity for civil society organizations to take a more active stance in contributing to policy dialogue. That, again, could happen despite a rather unfriendly policy environment. So it might be that the policy elements that I mentioned, so taxation, registration, volunteering, will remain unchanged, and yet civil society actors will be able to be more active in the European integration process. But then if they are more active in the European integration process, that should give them a better voice and a better opportunity to revise and to influence policy, and a general shift towards more open government policies. So when I did say that the policy consultation framework is imperfect, that's something that a lot of policy making experts would agree to, but there's a general tendency to increase the inclusive and consultative character of policy making in the country. So there are multiple frameworks that are not connected, but there's a general tendency to involve citizens and interest groups in policy making, and that might be one of the chances and opportunities for Albanian civil society to be able to argue for a more friendly policy environment for them. No, I didn't really check the time, but I hope that I can have another few minutes. Now, in terms of obstacles and challenges, they're very much related to what I already said. A general lack of political will. So there is no single driver of change. It's not the government, it's not the donor community by itself. There's a lack of political will to improve the policy environment for civil society organization. There is no single institution that pushes for that. The other one is the lack of capacity within government institutions, I mentioned on numerous occasions already. Poor policy making, so no enforcement, no follow-up, little evidence base. I mean, little evidence base for civil society research in general, and no evidence base to analyze sources of income, taxation situation, or the number of active civil society organizations in the country. General fragmentations of civil society, so there are a lot of coalitions around singular issues, but there is no wide umbrella or coalition for improving the general climate for civil society organizations. And on comes on top of that, as both cause and effect, is a lack of trust between civil society and government. So that would be very much seen within the National Council for Civil Society and within other bodies such as the public consultation system and the European integration process, that civil society organizations are sometimes not willing to engage in the dialogue because they don't think it's going to be effective, it's not going to have an impact. So they decide to act on their own and to operate on a local level or within the particular sector, but not looking at the wider support network and what is the situation for all civil society organizations. Okay, that would be the end of the presentation. And
thank you very much, Max. Thank you. For a very thorough and exhausting description of the whole situation of civil society and government efforts in Albania, but also for showing that how unclear the road ahead is in a way, which little has changed from other research that I had done years ago on civil society in Albania. There are a few things that I'd like to highlight from the presentation that you gave before we open the floor for questions and answers, if I am able to read my handwriting here. But the first thing that strike me in the presentation is at the start when you said that there was no civil society before 1991.
Organized civil society, that's what that would be.
That as well. Yeah. And because, you know, there is a lot of literature on how to define civil society, you know, whether we go from Tocqueville's definition or Marxist theory or even Gramscian, you know, concept of civil society. So I think there is a lot of literature that, as a concept, civil society is debatable. Sort of what makes civil society, what is civil society? A group of people that, whether they organize around an issue or topic that they feel strongly about, and whether they contribute voluntarily and things like this. I perhaps would think that I wouldn't necessarily think that it didn't exist before 1991, even in an organized form, especially if we think that a lot of the post-war reconstruction it was done on a volunteering activity on a topic that people thought would contribute the wider sort of, you know, benefit to the society. Mm-hmm. You know, the roads, the constructions that were made at the time was a volunteering activity. Mm-hmm. People had gathered around, organized, whether this was at work or women's organizations or even children's at school, you know, giving there. So there was some form of organizing. I think what we refer to as post-1991 is perhaps the international aid way of organized civil society that we were given as a new notions, new concepts, which some authors would also argue that there is another form of colonialism. So that is another topic that perhaps, you know, we could discuss. And this also might shed some light into the fact that if we don't see the development of civil society in post-communist countries, could it be a result that there is a different interpretation of what civil society means to these countries, whether there is a path dependency of the past or of the communism, the legacy of the communism, or just a refusal to neoliberal ideas of what civil society is? So these are only sort of things that I was, you know, while hearing your presentation, I was thinking about. And the other point is that you mentioned there is a known lack of coordination and coherence among government, among civil society itself. And I wonder how much to this picture is also affected by the lack of coordination by the international organizations themselves in the country, which haven't been the best example of how to coordinate mm-hmm. efforts while working with in the community. Mm-hmm. There is very interesting to see that there is some efforts in the process of consultation between the government and civil society, because I remember when I led one of the consultations on social protection and social inclusion strategy in 2013, it was the first time that the government was opening up to, and there was a lot of resistance to even drive the consultation on what mm-hmm. sort of stakeholders would think about the process. So I'm glad to see that there is some development, yet, albeit the development is to be questioned how much impact it will have on the policy-making process. Yeah. So, and also the sort of a general view as to what extent this stage of civil society that we see in Albania, which is not unusual in other countries in the region as well, to what extent this is just, if we would say, a feature of the wider society, the way things are, the way things are operating in the country and wider. I have a lot more topics that I've taken notes of, but I'll stop here. I don't abuse my position as chair. So these were just general views, but I'll open the floor for discussions, if that's okay. So if anybody has got any questions to ask or...
comments as well?
Comments mm-hmm. or... It's okay, so we've got Irene and the gentleman there and the gentleman here, so...
What about the church in all this?
Mm. And there was another question there.
Maybe it's the same question. I was also wondering about how you see the role of religious in society organizations. Also considering society organizations that might receive funding from a board that is, for example, not European, American, etc. Mm-hmm. But
do you want to take more questions, or shall we go on with this first?
Okay, I'll try to first. Soros and the Church. I can't put this in one question, but I'll start with Soros. I think, well, again, similarly to other countries in the region, or maybe any country around the world, it is a contentious. I mean, Soros's mm-hmm. involvement and the OSFA, so Open Society Foundation Albania. Are seen as politicized, yes, so that will be the short answer. They are an important player in the organized civil society world, and definitely in the process of consultation, especially those organized by the international donor community. So they are visible, and that's probably where the agreement would end. So they are visible, and that they have an influence. Where it's a good one or a bad one, you better be off asking civil society actors in Albania. There are a lot of civil society organizations who are full of praise for what they do, because they have their own independent source of funding, so they're not immediately dependent on EU or UN funding. They stand alone, and this allows them a certain level of independence and certain level of clout as well. But this does not mean that everything they do is universally positive. They have a lot of enemies within Albania, and the whole Soros system has a lot of enemies everywhere else. So I would say important, yes, politicized, or at least allegedly politicized also, yes. But also contributing quite a lot. And I talk about organized policy dialogue here, contributing quite a lot, not only policy process, but also in research terms. So if you look at research on civil society in Albania over the last at least 3-4 years, you would find a lot of good sources generated by the Soros Foundation in Tirana. The church... First, the general question, what about the church? I mean, I'm not an expert in Albania's religious organizations, so I can't comment about the picture sort of in the field. But what I can say with a high degree of certainty, there's very little visibility within the consultation frameworks I talked about. So when you talk about consultations and the participation of civil society organizations, it will be mostly the secular organizations. There is a lot of activity happening there, both on behalf of Muslim organizations and Christian ones in Albania, and others, but they'll be the two biggest ones. But I can't really comment on the size or the importance. What I can say, again, with a high degree of certainty, that they are not involved in shaping the civil society organizations framework. It might be because they see themselves as a different type of activity that is not civil society only, but there's also another element to it. And they would not be willing to contribute. But there is little visibility in whether the volunteering law or the taxation law or anything else. So not close to the policy side. And there was a question about the perception, those with non-European sources of funding. Again, I couldn't comment because, well, first of all, to the best of my knowledge, but I would say in this case it's pretty good because I came back from Tirana only last week, there isn't a consolidated source that would allow you to analyze its sources of income of Albanian civil society organizations. You could look at single cases, and there were cases where there were organizations receiving, religious organizations receiving funding from abroad that the Albanian government or the law enforcement community did not particularly welcome. There are allegations of money laundering. There are even cases of money laundering involving civil society organizations, and that also contributes to the lack of trust. But I couldn't comment on the overall place of religious organizations in that. They're definitely much more active than before, and there is a certain upsurge in religiosity within certain communities, but I wouldn't say it's a massive phenomenon.
If I could just add a thing to the question on churches, I don't actually currently know what the situation is, but in the previous government in 2013, I think there was established a collaboration between the government and the various religious groups in the country to be more closely working towards the needs of these communities. And I do remember the time at the Ministry of Social Welfare, there was a network of collaboration with, I think, the minister at the time, that was, who is the current mayor, was also working with these representatives of the religious groups to get their voices more represented and sort of to hear more of their needs. I don't know whether with the changes in the government that were done in the second sort of in the second Rama II government, whether this collaboration is still existing and whether this sort of is still established within the ministry, because the ministry was moved to join the Ministry of Health. So this was perhaps, but it was perhaps a government effort to sort of hear more of what the religious sort of groups representatives would, you know, would be the needs for. Okay, so any other questions?
Given the lack of differential treatment between NGOs and businesses, as an individual who wants to pursue social change, what is to stop me doing it in a profitable way? Or contrary to that, how would I think about approaching the actual framework for appraising NGOs to make it widespread that this is the treatment that everybody in this position should get from the government?
Got the first part. What would be the second one? Could you rephrase?
How do I pursue internal change within the government to come up with a new set of legislation and methodology for thinking about this is an NGO, this is the treatment you get because you're pursuing social change?
Oh, yeah. So a lot of it is already happening. So the first part is what is wrong with pursuing social change through profit making? Well, there's a discussion in there, but it is definitely possible within different formats. So obviously, as a business, you're also allowed to do, I mean, at least legally speaking, charity in any country, and you can do this in Albania. There is fairly recent legislation on social entrepreneurship, so you can try to use business ideas to drive social change within this, again, new and very much important concept in Albanian legislation, but that would allow you to combine elements of business activity that would be non-profit, but based very much on, so there are a lot of civil society organizations in Albania that would operate, I don't know, a flower shop or a cafe or a restaurant, and then channel all the profits into the charity. So there will be this part, the economic activity will be profit making, but the profit will be channeled into the charity profit. So that's possible. How do you drive change? Well, it's already happening. The thing is that it's not really very effective So you would have bodies like the National Council where civil society organizations would come forward and say, we would like this legislation to be changed. And the government would either say nothing, or the government would say, yes, we will do it, but they would not put a time frame on that. So if you look at the roadmap for civil society policy, a lot of the points that I mentioned here have been in a government document since 2015, but they have not been followed through. So the government is not saying we don't want to do this. They would say, yes, we will do it, but at our own pace, or there isn't a feedback. So a lot of the points, including business, but everything else, the government says, yes, we will do this. They just haven't. But they don't disagree in principle. They say it's all great to have a vibrant civil society. It might just take us a little more time. Avash, avash. So, yes.
Any other questions?
Sorry.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation. It was quite well put. I had a question. I mean, you talked a little bit about the distrust between civil society and the government,
mm-hmm.
and rightly so. But have you considered also the distrust that might be by the citizens and
mm-hmm.
international
mm-hmm.
donors?
Mm-hmm.
Because in 2014, this was unofficially that some EU institutions and others banned certain NGOs for not getting major grants because they had close tie to political organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know that there was fallout. So do you have any sort of evidence or have you measured why there is a distrust
mm-hmm.
by the citizens, also international
mm-hmm.
institutions?
So I would say that I do and I don't. So what I say I do is that actually the lack of evidence is part of the problem, and the lack of transparency is part of the problem. What I don't is I don't have a specific number. I cannot tell you how many civil society organizations in Albania engaged in fraud, or how many of the CSOs accused of having a political affiliation. And I guess if you're familiar with how things work in Albania, most of them would have some sort of a political allegiance, for good and for bad. It's just a fact, especially if they operate out of Tirana, most people would know each other and there will be some sort of a connection and an informal network. Again, nothing sinister about this in most cases. There will be some network there. So the lack of evidence is a problem and it contributes to the lack of trust. So there was a very recent documentary or one of those TV programs that uncovered fraud within, I think, two or three NGOs that would be collecting money on the streets of Tirana and channeling purportedly towards, I don't know, children's health institutions, hospitals maybe, and none of this would ever see the intended recipient. And it might have been the case for the three of them, but in the situation of absolute lack of transparency within the system, this resulted in lowering the trust, and there's nothing wrong with the journalist revealing this, and I hope this keeps happening. But in a situation where you can't really have a big picture, it doesn't really help much. So the accounts of civil society organizations in Albania are not made public. There is not a central database like there is now for businesses, so there is a fairly successful national business registration system, again copied from somewhere else and developed with donor assistance, but a pretty modern arrangement by which businesses in Albania are all digitalized, at least. That doesn't mean that the business environment is ideal, but the data is there. And this then allows you to build a picture of what it is, and also to increase trust. So you don't have the equivalent of the charity commission there, where you can look up where the sources of funding come from. Coming back to your question about religious organizations, there can be all sorts of allegations flying around because you can't see that. There is no transparency. So I don't know if that helps, but the lack of transparency in the system makes the situation worse.
NGOs are not listened to by policymakers so much because they're not distinguished from for-profit companies.
Mm-hmm.
I do research on civil society in different countries in Europe, and it seems to me that there is a tendency towards mixed fund organizations with mixed funding, so partly state, partly private.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or also a lot of close cooperation between private companies and NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you observe that, and
mm-hmm.
that has an effect when it comes to
mm-hmm.
be listened to by policymakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, first of all, the fact that civil society organizations are lumped together with businesses within the public consultations framework is not so much a result of a deliberate policy, is more of a matter of the fact that nobody thought about CSOs when they designed the system. As simple as that. There's no sinister plot to devoid civil society organizations of voice, or just to amalgamate their opinions with businesses for whatever agenda item. It's just nobody considered their interests and their place within the consultation system. When it comes to sources of funding, again, there's no specific data, but most research would point to the fact that most of the funding, a large majority, would come from private sources. So there would be some public funding, especially international donor funding. There would be some Albanian state funding, but very little, and a lot of this would come from private sources. So business cooperation with CSOs, yeah, very much happening at the moment, and a growing trend. But again, one that you cannot measure yet, because the tax exemption that has greatly boosted business contributions to civil society has not been measured yet. But I would say definitely visually out there, if you walk across Tirana, you probably see more billboards and more sort of presence of business and civil society cooperation than anywhere else I have. So there'll be businesses supporting hospitals, business supporting mostly, I would say, more publicly visible causes, so mostly environment, health, social development, fight against poverty, social inclusion.
To what degree would you say this is more a situation in Tirana rather than the rest of the country?
Well, it's difficult to answer for two reasons. One is that I've travelled across the country. I've been for civil society related research to Korcha, to Shkodra, and to Vlora, and there's some of this happening, but a lot of this would be managed from Tirana. So there will be one or two big charities that would operate out of Tirana that would have national presence, but I haven't seen any regional local initiatives. And the other one is that I think at the moment it's hard to find a number you can trust definitely, but somewhere between 60 and 70 active civil society organizations operate out of Tirana. Only 30 from outside. And it's not a total disbalance if you look at how the population is distributed, because I guess about a third of Albania would live in Tirana. Again, it's difficult to have an exact number, but it's not a total imbalance. So you have a lot of Tirana is the biggest city, and a lot of organizations would operate out of there. But generally, civil society is fairly concentrated within Tirana and Tirana County. So a lot of organizations would be there.
Any other questions?
Yeah. One, two, three.
If you were to compare civil society organizations in Albania with the region, how does it compare in terms of organization, framework, functioning? You know, in Albania itself, compared to Montenegro and Kosovo, Macedonia. I mean, there's this sort of ironic comment about Macedonia that ever since the new government came to power, there's no civil society, but the whole civil society is working for the government.
We just talked about this. Okay.
Everyone is happy.
So difficult to summarize the comparison in a single answer, because there are a lot of differences. I think a lot of the trends that I listed here could be observed elsewhere. Again, I haven't spent too much time in other countries of the region, and if you look at historical developments, you see a lot of difference between Albania and Kosovo, because you have a case of pretty much every single NGO being registered within the last 20 years, so there's a different historical perspective. But a lot of the trends would be very similar, a lot of the problems would be very similar, but there are a lot of things, and surprisingly enough here, yes, Macedonia does a better job of NGO taxation and VAT legislation, and Albania is actually looking at good practice coming from what's happening there in terms of, again, enabling civil society organizations to operate. But if I turn to another common joke, it's a bit like, you know, what about the European integration process and how do countries of the region compare? You know, the optimists say that Bosnia will enter during Albania's EU presidency, and pessimists say that Albania will enter during Bosnia's. So I don't think that differences would be substantial. There'll be some in sectors, but I don't think that it would differ massively. You could look into USAID studies on civil society sustainability that could give you a kind of a broad picture. But I'm guessing most of them in sustainability terms will be somewhere between 4 and 5, maybe 3.5 and 5, which is middle of the scale. I think there would be a difference in what's happening in Albania now and what happened in Macedonia under the previous government, where there was serious attempts and very successful ones at state control over civil society. This has never been the case in Albania in terms of an overall policy that would try to grab and control all civil society organizations. And, well, you would hear a lot of such comments coming out of Serbia these days, but I couldn't comment because I haven't looked in detail.
But this would be a continuation to, because what this concept of civil society through international aid that was brought into these post-communist countries, post-1991,
yeah,
is a way that the first people came across it were people working at the time in the government. So the donors came into the country, met them, informed them what this kind of approach would be. They informed some other friends to go and set up some NGOs,
mm-hmm,
and this is how it,
yep,
started. So these close links have always existed. So people,
mm-hmm,
fluctuated between the government and the civil society. So they were with one government, they worked there. When another government came, they lost their jobs, they went back to the civil society sector. And then another change of government might mean they will come back. So we see this kind of, which might explain also this sort of not much progress into this
yep,
whole concept of how civil society should be acting in the country. And there was a question, Alex. And
yes, I was just wondering, I haven't been to Albania actually, but it seems to me from, from what I've read online briefly, is that it's sort of trying to rebrand itself as kind of very green country, and specifically Tirana maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what is the relationship between kind of green civil society organizations and the government, for example, because in Bulgaria at the moment, this is a very fraught moment, and there is a lot of stigma and around green issues, and particularly
mm,
in those organizations that
mm-hmm,
work to preserve natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, could you say that, for example, in Bulgaria, in Albania, the relationship between civil society organizations and the government? Green
mm-hmm,
it could be a successful one, or is there a better example for a kind of for a better working relationship?
Again, difficult to talk about it from a comparative perspective in the region, because I've done most of my work in Albania, but I would say definitely very visible. So there was a question about religious organizations. I would say if you talk about the civil society frameworks, not very visible. I'm not saying they're not there, they might be just accessing government through different channels, but they don't actively participate in the civil society world as such, whereas environmental organizations are very, very active. And I haven't seen too many signs of the stigma that they see in, that you said is visible in Bulgaria. I'm from Poland originally, so I see a lot of this happening in Poland these days, a lot of pretty negative PR towards environmental-based organizations, and especially those that are activism-based, not so much campaign-based, but if it's a form of activism. Then they're perceived negatively by the government in the first place. So whether this trend will continue, I can't say. A lot of this, at least in Poland and possibly also in Bulgaria, had to do with the fact that the EU policy has a lot to do with how a country's environment will be treated. And it's one of the most relevant areas of accession negotiations. So if you look at the case of Croatia and the role of civil society organizations in this accession process, they were most vocal in rule of law, human rights, and environment. And I guess the same might happen in Albania, so there might actually be more opportunities to speak up. And if I look at the recent campaigns, so what's, well, still undecided, but what's happening in Valbona, or what happened regarding Gerdes, or the waste recycling idea, civil society did fantastic work to actually fight off some pretty bad policy ideas or some outright mad ones. And if it wasn't for them, I think that the government would get their way. So I think that they play a positive role and they are likely to continue. But they might face the backlash that we see in other countries, I couldn't say.
Is there any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
So you were first before, and then we have one here.
Questions. One is sort of a follow-up question, actually, on the one I asked before. And I was wondering, how did you see the presence of foreign civil society organizations, so independent of like whether they're religious or not,
mm-hmm,
just sort of like they're active and but originally based elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just wondering, in terms of your approach, how you actually tackle the topic mostly. Sort
mm-hmm
of. So, what are your points of contact?
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about getting
mm-hmm
them?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I can answer that. So one would be international civil society organizations. Quite a few, but probably not huge in number, quite significant in terms of influence. So the REG network, that's a big environmental network in Albania, one of the most efficient ones, was actually set up, I think, initially to an USAID project, and there are those REG networks all across Central and Eastern Europe. But from what I know and what I've gathered from the interviews with a lot of civil society organizations, they are seen as a force for good. So it is an international network. The idea was, you can say, imported from elsewhere, but they are the biggest grouping of civil society organizations in the country, and pretty much an industry body for those, as you can call, green NGOs. But there is a connection between those international networks and international donors. And here things get a little more complicated, because you get a lot of those donor organizations, so starting with the European Union family and the UN family and then World Bank, and that would rely on the opinions and inputs and the feedback of a group of organizations, and very often the ones that would benefit from their funding. So there are issues of transparency, definitely. And so when it comes to my approach, I spent most of my time in Albania doing policy-related work, so working for the European Commission. I'm currently involved in one technical assistance project that has to do with improving the civil society environment. And some of it I did when I worked for civil society myself, both in Poland and in the UK, and I work with civil society organizations, mostly from the youth and the volunteering sector. So that probably limits my view, and that's probably part of my bias, that I understand the civil society perspective more from this angle than, let's say, religious organizations that I haven't had the experience of working with individually or personally, and then I don't really see them much in those institutions that I'm dealing with. So no religious organization is represented within the National Council for Civil Society, none within the National Council on European Integration. And, well, I couldn't talk about the donors, recipients of government grants, but I haven't seen any religious organizations among those benefiting from state support, so grants provided by the Agency for State Support for Civil Society. I would say they're not very visible.
Yeah, going back again to the point on the blurry line between these organizations and government, given that maybe a big proportion of these organizations may be ex-politicians, depending on who is not in power, and also people from abroad, how do we stimulate an internal drive to be part of these projects for people who have nothing to do with this, given that people our age in Albania who've graduated might know a lot, but then there's such a high unemployment rate and things that they worry about isn't contributing to society as a general before like making a living for themselves? Mm.
Well, I could continue from your question and list all the issues that actually prevent this from happening.
You had an answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can add an answer, but this is a very important matter. So, civil society membership is pretty low. You have a lot of civil society organizations, but a lot of them would be, in business terms, small and medium enterprises. So, the largest one in terms of membership would be religious communities or trade unions. In terms of membership, maybe the environmental ones, I don't have the numbers, but having seen a lot of, let's say, social media activity, I'm guessing that either they have huge accounts to pay those famous Russian bots, or they just have a lot of membership and they have a lot of people who really support their agenda and subscribe in terms of members. But in terms of funding, membership funding is very rare among civil society organizations, so you have limited membership. And then there are a lot of additional disrupting factors, so you would have, yes, the same groups of people. On top of that, you would have high unemployment would be one, but the other one would be migration, both within Albania and outside of it. So international migration that affects young people a lot, and internal migration, mostly to Tirana, sometimes to the coast in the summer season, that would make any community activity difficult. It's not only civil society, doesn't even have to be organized, can be just a community-based project that is not registered, completely under the radar, does not face the first instant court of Tirana, difficult to organize because the links between people and communities are weakened. So I'm afraid I don't have the answer, and if anybody in this room would like to suggest a measure, I'll be very happy to.
So would you say that we perhaps have seen the purest form of civic engagement in the environmental movements rather than the civil society organizations and all the other terms, you know, SEOs, MPOs, CSOs, quasi-NGOs, goals, something that was a little, the latest term that I heard, which was government organized non-NGOs, which to me, I don't, to me, it's
Gongos, yes, very much a,
so
it's, yeah, it's a thing.
Can we say that there is a sort of a division between these two kind of spheres of engagement, the real engagement in voluntary work, which
mm-hmm.
is shown
yeah.
in these environmental issues, and the rest, which comes mainly incentivized from donor calls for applications
mm-hmm.
and projects and short-term proposals of activity?
There is a division, yes. I'm not sure it's only a division in two. There's probably several different ones. If you look at the motivations, and that's, again, something that it hasn't been fully explored, the motivation for people to join and be active in the civil society organizations. I think when you look at the very recent campaigns, it's very often around the things that are closest to people's hearts and not civil society proper, but you know, environmental issues or financial issues, tax issues, or the waste recycling issue was also environmental.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be closest to people's everyday realities, and that what drives membership. It's not the fact that those environmental networks have driven membership and then these people signed up. It's that the item at hand, the issue, was so important and so controversial that a lot of people rallied around this, and then eventually they joined or supported, because it's not very often it's not a case of structured membership. It's just that these people rallied around the Don't Touch My Valbona campaign because they feel that this is important to them. It doesn't mean that they were members of an organization. So I think it's more that the future will be in organizing those not so much activities, but issue-based approach rather than organizations building networks, because here, at least at the moment, I see very little potential and there's very little growth in numbers and membership of organizations. I'm not saying this is how it should be, but that's how I see the trend developing.
In the countries in the region, there have been new forms
mm-hmm.
of civil society, less
mm-hmm.
organized.
Yep.
I wonder to what extent there is contagion from those countries, and to what extent these are perceived as more authentic by the society,
mm-hmm.
because from what you're telling us,
mm-hmm.
the others are a bit created from mm-hmm. from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing would be, to what extent is there any dialogue with
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, I'm not suggesting that the civil society organizations, or majority of them for sure, was somehow foreign inspired. There was a lot of influence of foreign donors and foreign networks, but a lot of the organizations, or most of those that I met, were developed and based on genuine interest, usually around this particular issue. So you would have a lot of families affected by a certain medical condition that would rally around this policy issue, or somebody affected by an environmental change would rally around this. Or part of the country affected by an infrastructure project, and they would rally around that. Where there is a lot happening outside the formal or the institutional civil society, definitely. But I spend most of my time working on, first of all, government policy, and secondly, civil society organizations, not civil society at large. So I again couldn't comment on the extent of this. But especially if you go outside of Tirana, you'd see a lot of this happening. A lot of unregistered or informal groups that move things forward, and very often be on the back of the absence of a public service. So there'll be groups that organize again around environment, there'll be cleanups or charity collections of some sort, because there are no alternative provisions. Where if you're a Tirana, there are many other networks you can turn to, where outside of Tirana you cannot. But I couldn't comment on the size or the importance of that. I don't have the knowledge.
So can I go back to my first comment then about civil society during communism?
Yes.
So why do you argue that there wasn't?
My take would be, again, I haven't spent much time looking at civil society society in communist Albania, but having done some work on civil society in communist Poland, that was quite a different type of communism, I appreciate. But my immediate response would be that if a lot of the activity that you described was government controlled, I would have a problem classifying it as civil society proper. There will be a lot of, just on the basis of the example I'm not familiar with, but let's say the post-war reconstruction in Albania happened through people's voluntary effort. If it did, that's great. And a lot of this probably happened out of their will to rebuild their communities. But I'm imagining that the minute that it took some kind of an institutional format, so if more than 50 people decided to gather on the main square in Korcza in 1948, that would not be without supervision. So there will be a discussion to where do you actually make the cut, to what extent this is a civil society expression, and then it becomes
absolutely.
But then
we enter into another debate, which is to what extent the civil society is just an extension of government. And so if we expect the government now to enable this the situation for civil societies to operate, then it's another form of control in a way.
Because it depends,
you rely on them to create the conditions. So in that way, the post-war reconstruction was more sort of, you know, there was a lot of genuine contribution in that, in the volunteering work. We cannot talk about throughout the communism, because from the 70s things changed and sort of, you know, people saw the outcomes of their contribution. But there is a different debate to this, to where do you stop in terms of considering civil society just an extension of government, actually, or as it currently is another form of employment anyway.
There are few threads in this, but one is about, you know, the difference between control and enabling environment. What a lot of the points that I listed here were about just creating an environment that would do no harm to civil society organizations, would not burden them more than business organizations, that would not require them to go through all the red tape they have to go through at the moment, that they would not create legal loopholes or actually legally impossible situations like with the volunteering law. That would just enable them to operate, and there would not be a matter of state control. So I think there is a difference between state control of civil society and allowing it to freely operate. So that's what I say the difference.
We'll have to have a different presentation on this topic.
Well, it might take a few years. If it's about Albania, it might take a few years, but yes, thank you.
Is there any other questions or points to make? No?
The open government network forms of the government itself. So the ordinary person in Albania, they need to own their country. And to do that, it needs to, let's say, have a 100 penny, make £1, or whatever your money is, then everyone will need to pay £1, or whatever the dollar, or whatever. And then they'll be registered as individual there, despite the government or whatever is there already. But this needs to start by someone in partnership with the government and open government network, because people in the government start off just simple so, and the very poor would have a collection of that money, 10,000 people, the 10,000 pounds. They can get small money or two that to bring themselves out of poverty, bring them up a little bit, and then someone about you carry on here every city, you can look at what policy they have and use policy for yourself, something that you create yourself and share with other people. That way the big shots wouldn't be jealous of you because you're just helping people, and the babies and the poor people wouldn't be jealous either, because this is what caused wars and confusion around the world. Rich versus poor, and people with power don't want to share. But try to pass that power bit. It's just a single dollar or a single pound, 100 unit, whatever your money is, and start there.
Thank you.
It's an interesting point you're making, because we don't see a lot of civil engagement in terms of people protesting about employment or lack of employment and, you know, jobs and how to, you know, poverty and everything, but we see a lot of other sort of...
Closest to this would be the corruption, anti-corruption campaign, judicial
but
reform.
But that was fueled as well.
Yeah,
it's not
that's true, but not yet. But not so employment? I'm not familiar with one. It might be, but I don't know.
No, there isn't much in the region either, so...
Gentlemen at the back. Yeah.
Do you think it's a problem that people are normal citizens, they're suspicious of NGOs because they see the people that lead it, they're using it to, as a springboard to go into government, to go into any political party? Do you think that's a problem?
It could be a problem in certain cases, but I think it's good that people want due scrutiny and would like civil society organizations to be transparent like any other organization, especially if they receive public funding. So I think that the approach itself, I mean, when you say suspicious, maybe as an attitude that's not helping, but, you know, wanting the organizations to be transparent and to account for how they operate and how they spend public funding, yes. Now, when it comes to the revolving door syndrome, that is a little more difficult, because I don't think there are very efficient policy measures, at least on this side of things. If somebody wants to leave government and work for civil society, there's very little is going to stop them, and well, you probably don't have to go far even from this building to look for comparable examples. So it's not only happening in Albania. So I think suspicion, yes, it's fine, but if it's used for, in my case, I'll say in terms of policy solutions, to increase transparency, to increase accountability, then it's good. Mm-hmm. Then if it turns into a conspiracy theory that tells you that Soros runs Albania from his back office, then probably not. But if, yeah.
But this could be seen perhaps as a general social distrust, not only against
civil society,
but also against government, against, and there was a public opinion poll, I think, in 2016, end of 2016, which said that people trust perhaps international organizations more than they trust their government in Albania, or even other sort of institutions within the government, special access to justice and sort of prosecution. So if there is a distrust, a shared distrust among this sector, is perhaps a reflection of the wider distrust against institutions per se, so they are.
But isn't that a communist legacy that Albania has, where there is a complete distrust on institutions? So when I was doing my PhD on anti-corruption policies, and I took Albania as a case study, and I talked about the new reform, which is in the judiciary, most of those institutions are already in place in some, and now they're just rebranding them. And one of the sort of my takeaway was from many of the prosecutors and judges that I spoke and politicians was that there is a genuine distrust by the public on the institutions, because we have abused with the institution not just during communism but also in post-communism with 1997 pyramid schemes and so forth. So that will take some time, and I think if you look at the new European Commission strategy, which was on the Western Balkans, they actually point there now that we should move away from the checklist building institution and focus on transformative society. So that's what you can take away from it, that not just in Albania but the whole region, there's a genuine distrust on institution, and that will take time.
The whole region and in other countries as well, Western countries as well. So there is a general distrust, growing distrust against institutions per se, and that relates to quality of government as well. So when we look at Nordic countries that have sort of higher levels of quality, better quality of government or lower corruption, the way they did it, they didn't sort of build institutions first and then sort of, they got rid of corruption first in the institutions, then they started to sort of, and this could come as if governments, I don't know, one of the policies that has been suggested is increase the salaries in the public sector, so they won't be inclined to, you know, be corrupt or to be involved in corrupt practices, or make punishment so high that sort of no one would. So these are various ways, but yes, there is a bit of a legacy, but there's also a general reflection of not only the region there, but wider society is sort of, you know, against, I would say, institutions, I don't know, your view on that.
I agree. No, I totally agree with that. I mean, I would say not necessarily only communist legacy, in this case it is communist legacy, but legacy of any sort of bad governance, so whether it's colonialism or some form of occupation, just general distrust of public institutions. In that case, it was communism, and in the case of Albania, it was extremely severe form of it. So.
But I suppose as a citizen, if you see daily, sort of you have to go to hospital and you still need to pay a bribe to get a better treatment, then it affects your view of what an institution is. Even though it's not directly the government, it's someone within a particular hospital, but still your view is affected. Is
there a question at the back?
To what extent is this the consequence of the transition process itself?
That is another seminar, or maybe another PhD on Albania. I would think, looking at the processes and the deficiencies of the civil society environment, a lot of this has to do with the 1990s transformation and the fact that it was so unregulated, uncoordinated. And if I can only talk about the civil society policy bit, and it's a very tiny one, a lot of really bad policy decisions and governance by inertia in best cases, but making the wrong choices for civil society organizations without consulting them and others. That would be one answer. But you don't have to agree with me, right? So
no, I decided not to agree today.
Okay.
No, I do agree. I do agree. But I think there is the post-communist transition is the word transition itself is transition into something that, you know, there is a clear vision into. So a lot of these countries, in my opinion, a lot of these countries were transitioned into a state of neoliberal ideas that they didn't actually, they weren't expecting, they didn't know what they were, and they weren't the model that was given to them. So we don't have a capitalist system there as you'd expect in the West. So they didn't develop the way it was modeled about. The institutions didn't develop that way. The policies didn't develop that way. So what, to my opinion, and I've argued this in my research before, that there has been a language game between sort of the internationally defined concepts and institutions and policies brought into the country and the local government or civil society and people themselves. So they have played the game of, you know, you want civil society, then we'll develop it this way, so you have to tick all the boxes. So there is this sort of the anomy that took place as part of transition has led into this. So perhaps it will be the case, as it took in other Nordic countries, so it takes 20 years for the institutions to clear corruption before they even sort of make a good administration. It will take 2-3 decades or more, whenever transition it ends, for civil society to be a strong force into the issues that they feel about, rather than just an extension of the government. So I think everything plays a...
There is a document, 3 or 4 pages, for every country in the world has one. It's either from World War I or World War II. What was the paper? Because this needs to start somewhere, at the very beginning, somewhere where peace in the world started then, before about the United Nations. Then I think it happened before the United Nations. What was the original documentation that is for this country to make that happen? What we're talking about?
I'm not sure.
Yes, a small paper that everyone signed back then. I know because I had to use it when I went to Russia, and again I had to use it when I went to Turkey originally.
I'm not sure.
It's something there, and where was I buried there then, back then, after the war? Somebody need to find those documents, and for people to understand, well, or he's just pointing stuff.
Okay, but I don't know what document this might be. So.
We'll probably need to explore that.
A little document, it's not a big document, because it was meant for each country to go away with it. Maybe 4 or 5 lines. England one is 5 lines, the UK one is 5 lines.
So did the UK one say?
No, they don't call it capital, they call it a parcel. I can't remember, when I'm left here, I'm going to remember, so I'm going to shut up.
Well, you're going to make a lot of people Google tonight on the topic
that
you're...
But there is one, every country in the world have one, no matter how small you are. We need to go back then in time and find that. Where this Albanian, if it was German, whatever was the agreement there, the Western, wherever it was, everyone has one.
Mm. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. If there is no further questions or discussions, I'd like to thank Max very much for his very thorough presentation, and hopefully there will be some developments that will bring us some. Hope that things are changing and a better development of civil society and stronger civil society in the country, but not only, in the region as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping the capacity building and anything else that is being brought into the country will help the government as well to enable civil society to create the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much, and thank you for coming tonight. And see you.
Thank you.
Now. I apparently haven't finished because I've got to inform you as well about the forthcoming events we have got here. So we invite you to join us again on the Thursday the 8th of March for the LISI book launch, Rival Power, Russia in Southeastern Europe, with the speakers Dmitry Bechev from the North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and other speakers, Tim Judah, and the event will be chaired by Professor James Kerry Lindsay. And the next event will be on Monday, the 12th of March, 2018, which is Greek Exports and Corporate Adjustments. Speakers will be Professor Anthony Barsokas from the EBRD, Peter Samfi, again from the EBRD, and also fellow senior fellow here at LISI, We discuss in Professor Manolis Galenianos and chaired by Dr. Vasilis Monasteriotis. So you are all welcome to this event. Thank you.
Thank you very much.